This is The Takeout.
Ask not what your country can do for you.
With Major Garrett.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
At this defining moment, change has come to America.
And we will make America great again.
Welcome to the very best part of my broadcast week. I'm Major Garrett, as you well know, the host of this podcast, The Takeout. Join us, I am every week, by the world's greatest podcast sidekick, the political director of CBS News, Steve Shigaris. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Major. You know, I feel like the Sherman to your Mr. Peabody.
Sherman
just
to Mr.
Today.
Peabody.
Today.
Folks, that's going to be very relevant in just a couple of moments. Now, I'm just going to make a statement here. There is a very fine line between inventiveness and idiocy, between gaudy ambition and taking a ridiculous risk. We live right now on that very fine line between inventiveness and idiocy, gaudy ambition, and ridiculous risk. Allow me to explain. I have to take off for the president's trip to the Middle East and Europe tonight on this Thursday. This podcast is going to be an advance effort to evaluate that trip before it even happens. Now, how might we do that? Well, I'll explain that in a second. But one thing we're not going to do is we're not going to go into a Wayback Machine. And what's a Wayback Machine? Well, let's listen.
Hello, my name is Peabody. I am a genius.
And my name is Sherman. I'm a boy. Mr. Peabody's boy.
Set the Wayback Machine for the 6th century, Sherman.
6th century it is, Mr. Peabody.
That's it, ladies and gentlemen. For those of you watching on CBSN, this is my own copy of Mr. Peabody and
Major
Sherman.
And the trusty sidekick.
And trusty sidekick, that's right. J. Ward Productions, full credit given to the creative geniuses behind this cartoon, which first debuted 1959. On ABC, I wasn't quite born yet, but I do have vivid and happy memories.
Are we going to 42 BC?
Sherman and Mr. Peabody. No, so we're not going to have a Wayback Machine. No, the fine line between idiocy and inventiveness is we're going to have a Way Forward Machine.
Like
a
Back
way
to the
forward
Future
Machine, exactly. We're going to try to anticipate some of the issues and some of the dimensions of the president's trip before it even happens. And this podcast will land when the trip is about two-thirds over. Now, most reasonable people would never sit down and attempt such a thing. I would do it because I'm a knucklehead. You would do it because you're my knucklehead sidekick.
I'm more on the side of the idiocy than the inventiveness,
precisely.
By the way, just FYI.
But we have dragooned a very intelligent person, Heather Connolly, to join us to assist us in this possibly noble, possibly ridiculous, idiotic, and fruitless adventure.
Oh, it'll be great, maybe.
Exactly. Now, who is Heather Connolly? Well, she has a title, which I'll read, but then in a second she's going to explain to us what she actually is and who she actually is. So Heather Connolly has this fantastic title, which is Senior Vice President for Europe, Eurasia, and the Arctic, and Director of the Europe Program, Center for Strategic and International Studies. Heather, welcome to the Takeout Podcast, and help us build this Way Forward Machine.
Major, I am delighted to be living on the edge with you guys. Sherman and Mr. Peabody, thank
Sherman
you.
Sherman and Mr. Peabody, exactly.
It's great to be with you. So that is an awfully long title that my children do not quite know what I do for a living. So let me explain.
Yes. Sorry, throw my questions about Antarctica out.
Yes, it's okay. Arctic, okay?
Thank you. I like to cover a lot of territory. So the Center for Strategic and International Studies is a think tank in Washington. I analyze U.S. policy and policy as it develops in Europe, Russia, Eurasia, Turkey, and we even go to the top of the world and we take a look at the Arctic. So how I landed there, I'm a recovering State Department official in
actually
the Bush administration.
Yes.
I did. I was the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bush administration and from 2001 to 2005 under Secretary Colin Powell. I've worked for private sector and consulting and the American Red Cross, from the humanitarian organization. I've worked in government and now I bring all those ideas, and I come to the think tank world, and hopefully, I always live on the edge. We're always the way forward machine, because we've got to be ahead 6, 12, 18 months. What's coming down the road for U.S. foreign and security policy? Where do we need to be, and what do we need to watch out for? So I'm ready for this machine. Let's go.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways we like to build every bit of machinery here at the Takeout Politics, Takeout Podcast, rather, is to talk about terminology that everyone in Washington thinks they understand, but might not. And many Americans hear, but are maybe not familiar with what they actually mean. So let's just take something really simple. What's a think tank?
All right, great. Think tank, so we are bipartisan. So we do not have an ideological leaning. We're not Republican or Democrat. We are strictly bipartisan. What we do is we do research. We get funding from foundations, individuals, sometimes the private sector, sometimes governments, the U.S. government, sometimes foreign governments, to study really tough, difficult problems in foreign policy and security policy. We try to get the best minds together from a lot of different views, and we say, okay, if we can figure out what the problem is, then what should we do about it? Where should U.S. policy be? So we really offer recommendations, and again, we try to get ahead of the issues, not looking backwards, but where we need to be.
And so, sometimes think tanks are either way stations after government service, or they are a prelude to government service.
So sometimes what's unique about American think tanks is that we do have, it's a circulation process. So many times former officials will leave government service, they'll come back out, do some thinking, and reading and talking, and they'll write books and they'll think about some of the challenges that they faced, and sometimes they'll go back into government, but not always. We sometimes have people that are just experts, scholars in their field that have been doing this for decades and are the leading experts in their particular field. But we do have a process that, you know, folks come in, folks come out. The best day in a think tank's life is when we work on a project really hard, we get it, you know, right when it needs to be, the issue. We've been researching for a year or 2 years, but it comes out. And then someone says, you know what, that idea that you said, we're going to do it. And we're like, great, go do it. How can I help?
We have a sound effect for that when that happens, don't we?
Oh, good.
Bing, 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 bing.
I like it. I like it.
How does, speaking of that.
Sherman, go ahead.
thank you, sir. How does your world change when presidents change? How does that change in your life in terms of a think tank?
So the good news about bipartisanship is that we want to offer the best ideas, and we don't care who takes them, who gets credit for them. And we bring both folks from the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, we get them all around the table because we need them to talk to each other. Because the best policy is when it is based and grounded on bipartisanship. And it's about strengthening U.S. national security. That's what we do. So it should not matter. Unfortunately, bipartisanship, like in our domestic politics, has really gone into the foreign and security policy world, whether that was the Iraq War, the Iran nuclear agreement. Now we're partisan. We got to stop that. And so CSIS holds this sacred ground for bipartisanship, and now it's more important than ever. So we that's what we do. So it doesn't matter what the administration changes, but what's made the Trump administration so unusual, and as a candidate, Mr. Trump was really challenging, some would argue blowing up, tenets of U.S. foreign policy that have been built since the Second World War. And that has shaken all of us up because we made an assumption that this was pretty much a given and it's no longer a given anymore.
And so how does that shakeup process affect the planning for this trip and the likely expectations for this trip?
Well, and it gets back to your point about the circulation of the think tank community. So often we know who the colleagues are that are going into government. We know their work. We know their thought pattern. And we can discern, okay, we know. We've got that. They're going in this area. We don't know very many people in this administration other than the most senior folks. So we don't have that instinct of, oh, I know X. They're the assistant secretary, and they're going to do this. So that's a mystery.
And I would just say as an interjection, a lot of Trump supporters would say that's music to our ears. Well, we're happy about that. We wanted things completely, if not toppled, shaken to their core in Washington, and we're okay with that. Well, that might be an inclination they might have.
But one of my questions is, so what are the pros and cons of that kind of uncertainty and unpredictability, and some might say undisciplined behavior?
So there's two things. You're absolutely right. The 2016 election was anti-Washington. It rejected all of us, including think tanks and experts. If you knew something...
Especially me.
Yeah, well...
I feel it was deeply personally rejected.
It was
don't
very
deeply
personal.
Personally
we
rejected.
Still love you, Major.
So rejected.
Very focused on you.
Totally.
Anyway, but...
Everything's about me, folks. You've got to know it.
For the rest of us. So it was. And in fact, expertise. You know, if you know something... bring a whole new, you know, group of people in. So that's been actually a problem because while you may not agree with where U.S. foreign policy has gone in the last 20 years, and that's absolutely appropriate and understandable to challenge that, but these are people that have decades of experience of knowing who the key players are, what the history is, what the issues are. We don't, you know what, we can make new mistakes. We don't want to make the same mistakes. And if there aren't people deeply grounded in expertise, you really have this unpredictable and you're tearing up foreign policy that everyone thought was pretty accepted.
Now, people who supported Donald Trump will say, well, this is coming from the people in the swamp. This is coming from the people
drain
in the establishment.
The swamp.
Are there any pros to that attitude?
To a fresh
that you
look.
See, right.
To a fresh look.
Oh,
right.
I have no problem with a fresh look and new sets of eyes and new energy. In fact, there's absolute legitimacy to that. I think we've gotten stale and comfortable. Washington thought they knew everything. And, you know, we should be open to that. But what I think is so important is that we bring fresh set of eyes that have deep, rich experience that can get us where we need to go.
So when you talk to senior administration officials, they say, look, president gets a lot of noise and a lot of criticism because he's unpredictable. But when the NATO general secretary came to the White House, he said, you know what? We heard you. You said NATO members have to step up and spend more. NATO membership requires 2% of GDP on collective security. And the White House advisors I talked to say, why doesn't the president get any credit for that? He was hammered during the campaign for that. And now the Secretary General of NATO standing next to the president in East Room says, you're more or less right. They would say that's a classic example of a new idea that rattled a lot of existing structures, but got to an underlying truth and made people uncomfortable, but move things in a way that might help the United States.
So the United
States,
right, the United States has been encouraging NATO members to spend more in their defense for decades. Decades.
But much more quietly than this current president did during the campaign.
So I would argue after the end of the Cold War, we did not focus enough attention on this. But what's misunderstood is ever since Russia annexed Crimea, invaded eastern Ukraine, Europe's migration crisis hit, and they needed to increase border control and internal security. And then our election...
As well as refugee assistance.
Absolutely.
Real money, real dollars for real human beings.
That's right. Europe had already been increasing. Now, here's where I argue with the president's, you know, I'm getting them to pay, give me credit for that. Because they're, speaking of fine lines... We want them more. We want Europe to pay more. We want them to have increased defense capabilities. But it's not a pay to play. It is not, if you don't spend more, you know what? Maybe I'll be there. Maybe I won't. And so that's what builds uncertainty. I think the president has confused price with value. You can say, how much have you spent? What's your billion euros? But the value of the alliance, the country that survives has allies. And what we've been doing, in some ways, the unpredictability, our allies don't know if we're going to be there full on. And that's the problem.
It's the businessman's mindset, right? And
absolutely.
I want to ask you a question about that in the next segment.
Yeah. In the next segment. Thank you, Sherman.
Where are we, by the way, Major?
We are at Mewah Restaurant, the ancestral home of this podcast. The ancestral home. That's a happy sound
lunch.
You hear around it. We are very hungry. I want lunch. And I think dear and treasured podcast listeners and CBSN watchers, you know I love you. I think it's clear now. We could not have asked a better mechanic to join us here to build the Way Forward machine than Heather Connolly. We will begin to build that Way Forward machine when we come back.
Listening to The Takeout.
How lucky are you? I mean, honestly, how lucky are you to be listening to The Takeout? Extremely lucky. I'll just tell you that right now. I'm Major Garrett. joined, as I always am, by the world's greatest podcast sidekick, Steve Chigueras, political director of CBS News.
How much luck is really involved in people downloading a podcast and listening?
Lots and lots of luck.
A lot of luck.
They know it. Right now, on the treadmill,
we appreciate
in the house,
it.
Walking the dog,
whether
whatever
it's
you're
luck,
doing, by ev- whatever
whether
means
it's
you downloaded this, whatever means you found it into your podcast menu, we thank you, and we know you're lucky, and
cheers.
We know you feel lucky about that. As you know, treasured and cherished listeners of this podcast, new episodes of The Takeout are available every Friday morning. We earnestly and most sincerely invite you to subscribe, rate, and comment on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google, and Spotify.
Bing,
go to Takeout.
Bing, Bing.
Thank you, Mr. President. Go to takeoutpodcast.com. Follow us and like us, if you please, on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Takeout Podcast. That's at Takeout Podcast. As you know, treasured CBSN watchers, I'm waving to you now, and to our podcast listeners, we have the thing, the Takeout Podcast sticker with my autograph. And there is only one way and one way only you can obtain said sticker. Steve Chigueras, Sherman, will you let them know?
Well, yes.
And then also talk to us about some of the mail we have received in this process.
Absolutely. If you would like your very own Takeout Podcast sticker signed by Major Garrett, send your request along with a self-addressed stamped envelope to Takeout Sticker, care of CBS News at 2020 M Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20036.
What kind of envelope is that?
That would be a self-addressed stamped envelope.
Heather, you can't get it any other way.
Last week we had a
no social media requests, no emails will be
not
accepted.
Not even for guests?
I'll bring
if
her
I'm
one.
Really good at the end?
Yeah, we can get her one.
Right. Really?
But we'll take that under advisement.
People okay. who aren't sitting, people who aren't members of the Takeout Podcast Hall of Participants.
Hall of Participants.
Have to
yes.
send a self-addressed stamped envelope.
But don't you are forget, a member of the Hall of Participants.
Don't forget the stamp. Anyway.
Don't forget the stamp.
To date.
Mail.
96 pieces of mail in our mailbags.
96 pieces of mail.
From 30 states and the District of Columbia. Thank
and
you, Tatiana
thank you
Krachenko,
Tatiana.
Our producer this week. I got to read you a couple of
please do.
Couple of pieces of mail. First of all, from Wayne. This might be my favorite letter we've received.
High
date.
Praise. High praise.
From Wayne
favorite letter.
And Kim. And I hope I'm pronouncing your last name right. Wayne and Kim Halley from Salem, Oregon. My wife is deciding how this important example of our erudition, the Takeout sticker, should be matted and framed and displayed in our home.
Matted, framed, and sticker. Displayed. We love that.
Quite possibly we will have to install special lighting for it, as we feel that the family and friends and the FedEx crew will want to examine it closely.
Proper and appropriate lighting.
This sticker
big
is a
fans
serious
of that.
Thing,
votive
know.
Candles. Think
votive.
Votive candles.
Whoa.
Heather's just now qualified for a Takeout Podcast.
Yes.
Right then and there.
I'm going to have to cut that voted clip for
candles.
Later. Your
I'm
show,
put that on my
your show brings,
iPhone. That's going to be my
your
ringtone.
Your ring.
Votive candles. Yes.
Excellent. Your show brings joy to the end of our week. We always get a kick out of watching Major eat and drink. It is a testament to the traditional American diet. Of course, Steve
American.
Always brings balance to the meal, and we feel healthy again when we see what he orders.
Right.
I'm glad
yes.
people are taking note.
My side of the scale,
although I'm not
lard and
healthy.
Gin. Your side of the scale, I don't know. You fill in the blank.
Whatever. I've got the chicken and asparagus coming
there
this week.
There you go.
Okay.
I see some calligraphy.
Letter number two.
Excellent.
From your neck of the woods, Jim White in Chula Vista,
Chula
California.
Vista. For those of you from San Diego who are of my age, you remember when KCBQ was the number one rock and roll station in San Diego? It used to be called Chula Vista. Remember that, San Diego?
What happened?
It moved on.
Oh. Chula Vista. Jim, with this lovely calligraphy, thank
lovely.
You so much for taking the time to do all this. But he has
it
a,
might
he,
be a fun.
He has a point. Actually, we can probably use this as a kicking off point to our next topic.
Let's go.
With Heather.
Segway Sherman.
Even after the nuclear holocaust that the Donald seems to be pushing us toward, please
that's
continue to produce the Takeout Podcast. I can assure you, Jim White from Chula Vista, California, that we will continue this podcast as long as we are physically and mentally able to. For the
as
physically
long
part, I'm sure
as
Major
we are
will.
Physically and mentally.
Mentally,
able.
I might be out of here in the next couple of weeks, but we will continue for as long as we can.
Physically now, and mentally, we are always hanging by a thread. Heather.
Nuclear holocaust. Let's go.
Take that ball and run with it in the way forward machine.
Are we headed
you,
there?
It's
we,
the nuclear football.
Are we,
hang
are we
on.
Headed there? There are some people yeah. who are saying that, given the talk coming out of this president, that we are headed toward a nuclear holocaust. True, false? Where are we?
Well, hold on a second. Let's
slow down.
I would say most people think that that talk is not being generated by this president, but by Kim Jong-un.
Well, and there you go. So let's talk about there is
leader of North Korea.
An existential,
but is he being instigated by this president?
Look, there's an existential threat here from North Korea that last week's new firing of a new rocket, which potentially the trajectory now can reach Guam, close to Hawaii.
And by last week, we mean 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, sorry.
Thank you.
Thanks for the
Mr.
catch.
Peabody.
Way back machine, way forward. But this is a regime that is truly hell-bent on acquiring nuclear capabilities to threaten the United States. That is the most serious business that we can be in right now. And for far too long, quite frankly, this is a bipartisan comment, administrations have kicked this can down the road. They've tried different methods.
It'd be the Clinton administration. It'd be the Bush. But you were a part of the Bush administration.
Exactly. And
when the Bush
Obama
administration made concessions.
Mm-hmm. Yep, we tried everything.
Big concessions.
Yes.
To the North Koreans in hopes that they would make good on their promises at the time to retard the growth of this nuclear program. And they basically took that administration and this country for suckers.
Absolutely. So this has been a growing problem. In my view, we cannot effectively negotiate with this particular regime because they believe their survival is based on acquiring this capability.
And is that irrational? Whether we like it or not is one question, but is it irrational? Because as I've been in Washington since 1990, watched administrations wrestle with this nuclear question, not just in North Korea,
Iran.
But elsewhere, Iran, nations that do not have them work very hard to possess them for very, to them, logical strategic reasons. Because once they possess them, they are in possession of a negotiating chip on the table unlike any other. Is that not from their perspective? I'm not talking about that I'm advocating for it or I'm endorsing it or I'm pleased about it. But from their narrow perspective, is there not an inherent strategic logic to it?
Not only is there not, there's an inherent strategic logic, they have two examples. Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons, Russia invaded them. Libya gave up their biological chemical weapons, Muammar Gaddafi what invaded, overthrown, killed. So they actually think you give these up, you endanger your survival. So there are, the negative things. Absolutely, you cannot.
There's theory and real-world examples.
Absolutely. So this is a regime that has been closeted. What their perceptions are, we have no idea. We have very limited view into that, even China. Because over the last 2 years, Kim Jong-un has executed some of the closest advisors that the China had. We're losing visibility into this regime and literally weekly tests of missiles. This could not be more serious. In fact, during this presidential trip, we could see another test. We could even see potentially a nuclear test. I mean, this continues to go and the pace is being increased.
So let me run a couple of options by you. And for our CBSN audience and for those listening, you're going
to
hear some clinking of plates. Yes, because
Johnny's here with us.
Johnny here always yes. takes care of us at Maywa.
You know who's
fantastic Chinese restaurant just south of DuPont Circle and about a block and a half from the CBS Bureau. That's why we're here. The ancestral home of the Takeout Podcast. Johnny, Heather has, our wonderful guest, Heather has the fried rice.
Thank you.
And isn't that amazing?
Yum.
And it is a significant groaning platter of fried rice.
I will need a takeout bag.
So let me run a couple of options by you.
Absolutely.
Blockade of North Korea. Does that make sense?
So I think what we have to start addressing is reducing the hard currency that the Kim Jong-un regime has. And again, the President Trump is not incorrect that China does hold an incredible amount of influence and key to this, but China does not want instability. China's preference is status quo. They don't want THAAD, the U.S. Missile defense system around. They don't want more U.S. military presence. They want stability, particularly before President Xi goes into his party Congress in October. So they don't want to do anything, and they've been allowing, on the one hand, they're saying, yes, we're tightening up and we're turning around a coal shipment. On the other hand,
oil's still flowing.
So they
labor,
want stability. They
currency.
Don't want this fixed.
Right.
And that's the problem we have. So, yes, we can really, and by tightening sanctions, we're tightening on Chinese firms.
Right.
And so that doesn't help goodwill with
so
getting
blockade
Beijing
North Korea
to help
means
us.
Nothing.
I think it's limited. Who knows what the best combination is, but I think we have to slow this technical program down, and we have got to start increasing the price for the regime.
I want to use China as a jumping off point to sort of broaden this out a little bit. So we've seen the president back off some of his tough talk on a lot of these foreign policy issues during the campaign and even at the beginning of his presidency. I guess my question to you is this. This is clearly a strategy that he has used during his business career. If you read The Art of the Deal, it's chapter 2, the negotiation. You start off really extreme and then you moderate. How do you think applying the art of the deal to foreign policy, is that a winning strategy? Is that something that's going to just create so much uncertainty that it's just problematic? I guess my question to you is, can he make that work?
So there are some elements of business negotiations that do inform how you deal with another party. I think where the president misunderstands is that when you have neighbors, this is not a one-shot deal. It's not where you put a maximalist position and you're going to strong-arm them. And then, you know, if it doesn't work, you walk away from the deal or, you know, something else resolves. We're not going to walk away from Mexico. They're on our border. We can't walk away from Canada. We can't walk away from countries that are pointing nuclear weapons at us. So there's elements of, yes, there's toughness. And we always focus. I mean, U.S. foreign policy is, at its core, America first, because it's always about U.S. interests, security interests, economic interests. We have to defend those. But if you are always going to come out with the most extreme position, you have nowhere to grow and go. If the president himself is going to lead all the negotiations himself, you have nowhere to go and grow. You create a strategy, a plan. You stick to it. You don't deviate from it. You're predictable for your allies. You give your adversaries a lot of new challenges. And what my concern is, other countries now have figured out the president is very tough rhetorically, but the action hasn't been changing. They're starting to break the code a little bit. So I think it's wearing off. But we'll see.
Don't you love, dear listeners, the timelessness of this conversation? Really, this conversation could occur in any time continuum. I promised you we were going to build a way forward machine. In segment 3, you're going to listen to the actual construction of a way forward machine. We're joined by Heather Connolly, Senior Vice President for Europe, Eurasia, and importantly, the Arctic, and Director of the Europe Program for the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I'm Major Garrett, and as you know, you are happily and joyfully listening to The Takeout.
I'd like to talk today about how to develop a new foreign policy direction for our country, one that replaces randomness with purpose, ideology with strategy, and chaos with peace. It's time to shake the rust off America's foreign policy. It's time to invite new voices and new visions into the fold, something we have to do. From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first. We will seek friendship and goodwill with the nations of the world, but we do so with the understanding that it is the right of all nations to put their own interests first. We do not seek to impose our way of life on anyone, but rather to let it shine as an example. We will shine for everyone to follow.
You know, in our treasured audience, that is the voice of the 45th President of the United States, Donald Trump. The second soundbite you heard was from the inauguration address he gave to the country. The first soundbite was from what, in the White House, we are told over and over, those of us who covered on a daily basis, was the most important speech delivered by candidate Trump. It was a foreign policy speech delivered in Washington, April 27th, 2016, where he began to articulate, after formulation inside the campaign, what America First meant and how he would carry that agenda forward if he became president. So for those who were trying to get a sense of President Trump's approach to foreign policy, White House advisors tell me, read the April speech. So I will tell you, reassociate yourself with that April speech, because that speech then is now what many White House advisors tell me now still circulates through the president's vision of how to approach foreign policy. Heather Connolly is our guest. This is segment three of the Takeout Podcast. I'm joined, as always, by Steve Shigaris, political director of CBS News. So, Heather, as we look at this first foreign policy speech, lots of White House advisors have told me this speech is about explaining to the world that America is back in charge, that it is setting the agenda, and when it comes to any negotiation, America's going to ask for its share up front and then deal with your share in recognition that America's needs go first. Is that a doable foreign policy? Is that a rational foreign policy?
Ultimately, any country's foreign and security policy is based on their self-interest. So every, you know, there's an America first policy, there's a Saudi first policy,
there's an Israel first policy.
Absolutely. So that, yes, absolutely. The question about American foreign policy is that at the end of the Second World War, the United States decided it was in its interest to not go to two, you know, major theaters of war and the conflagration that occurred during the Second World War, that a new system had to be created to preserve America's security and America's economic prosperity. Now, what's so ironic about the president coining the America First, that was from Lindbergh. That was before the Second World War.
Charles Lindbergh.
They did not want the U.S. to get involved in Europe.
Right.
As Churchill was trying to get us because of the growing strength of Nazi Germany. And what happened? The Japanese invaded Pearl Harbor. We were struck. We tried to stay isolated. We were struck. And then we had an extraordinary cost to fight a world war on two fronts. So the system was designed with U.S. leadership, but it was for U.S. self-interest, economics, and security. What Mr. Trump is doing in asserting America first is that it's all about what the U.S. is interested in. You will pay us, but then you will do what America wants you to do. Now, another country is going like, now, wait a minute, let me get this right. I'm going to pay you to serve U.S. interests. What about my interests? Mm-hmm. Now, when those interests coincide, and you would have seen that when the president went to Saudi Arabia, the first stop of his trip was probably the best example of that, because there are, in some ways, these coincide.
There's anxiety in Saudi Arabia about Iran?
Huge anxiety. And they felt that President Obama tipped the scales in the Middle East the absolute opposite way.
By negotiating with Iran, first secretly and then openly,
and
to achieve the nuclear deal.
And more open to, as President Obama said, you know, you guys got to sort of be, you're going to have to be okay with Iran playing a bigger role in the Middle East. And the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia said, not only are we not comfortable with that, we're really not. And so in some ways, when our interests coincide, it's great. But do not underestimate that countries will work with the United States when their interests are taken care of, and they think that we're predictable in that. Countries are shying away if they're not sure we're going to be predictable, if the president can deliver on his strong rhetoric.
I'm looking at this trip as the first test, not only for the president, foreign policy-wise, but for the staff that he has surrounded himself with. What are you looking for, I guess, in terms of a confidence level in this staff that he has assembled to deal with foreign policy? Generally, what is your confidence and what you know of the people that he has surrounded himself with?
So there have been rumors afoot. Major, you probably know all the rumors better than I do, of yet another major White House shakeup. There have been rumors, press reports, that the president's not happy with General McMaster, or just not happy, feeling like there's
the National Security Advisor.
Exactly. There's chaos in some ways, and that he's been blindsided by impact of decisions that he's made. So I would say that we have a government.
Let me just interject.
Yeah,
by the time this podcast airs, things might have happened.
Exactly.
We don't know. It's an ever-changing environment, and we are living in a timelessness and a deference to that ever-changing environment, but we are pressing forward on that very ragged edge between ridiculousness and inventiveness.
We'll see what it looks like when we step out of the DeLorean.
Exactly.
I love with the smoke the coming out. So what I would say about the foreign and security team, it's still very incomplete, and we're at the end of May. So you have Secretary Mattis at the Defense Department, Secretary Tillerson, the State Department, now General McMaster, second National Security Advisor at the White House, National Security Advisor. You, as yet, they're now going through the confirmation process. You don't even have their deputies yet.
We shouldn't forget about Jared Kushner.
Well, and that's a great point. Let me get to that, because in some ways there's two.
Thank you, Sherman.
Exactly. So good. There's two parts of the foreign and policy security team. There's the official part that gets confirmed and we know and has meetings with all the government officials, and then what I call the unofficial part. And this is where Jared Kushner, Ivanka Trump, where they play such an outsized role. The family. And in fact, the example that I give, when Chancellor Angela Merkel was here, Chancellor of Germany met with President Trump. Probably one of the most decisive elements of that meeting was the business conversation, and Ivanka Trump was very instrumental in helping that visit. So what that tells foreign leaders is, well, it's great that we talked to Secretary Tillerson, and that's fine, but we've got this other thing. Well, and that Mr. Kushner does hold the really critical portfolios, the Middle East portfolio, Mexico. I mean, these are major policies. Major Garrett, major policies.
We like
related to major policies, aren't we?
Very well. My uncle. Uncle but, major policies.
So, but it is confusing.
Middle name Jeremy.
So the team, this is going to be just so tough. The team is, it's a little bit of a mixed bag. Now, everybody's going on this trip. I'm surprised that you have a seat on the aircraft.
I do.
But
he's in steerage thanks to Jared taking his seat.
Again, this tells you that this is a big apparatus, both the official, the unofficial part. And again, diplomats here in Washington will say they don't have their mid to senior level counterparts to talk to. It's a problem.
But there's going to be a big Saudi play.
Huge. This is really the Saudi visit is the keystone.
This will have already happened, dear listeners. But the Saudis are going to put on a huge show.
Massive.
A huge show.
Three summits.
On behalf of President Trump. They're trying to send a signal to Iran.
Yeah.
Help our listeners and our viewers understand what the dynamics of that are. How the Sunni Shia, the Arabist, the Islam, the Persian element. I mean, it's not an easy thing to explain. I grant you. But try to help us understand, because a lot of other things are going to happen on this trip. G7, NATO. But I really do think, for symbolism's sake, where it starts is where it's most important.
No, I agree. No, and the Saudi is the big point. So in some ways, what's so ironic is past presidents have focused more on undoing what their predecessor did than I think in some ways focusing on where their legacy. So in some ways, some have coined this as the anti-Obama tour. So if you remember when President Obama, in his first few months in office in 2009, gave this very big Cairo speech, which he laid out sort of the new U.S. framework to the Middle East, President Trump's going to do a major address on Islam.
And, in Riyadh.
In Riyadh, exactly. And in some ways, that's the counter. Again, it was perceived by Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states that the Obama administration, and you can hear this now even reflected in interviews before you depart on the trip we've already had, anything's got to be better than the last administration. They felt they were so focused on giving Iran such a strong, the Shia dominant Iran and its growing regional hegemony, that the U.S. was supporting that. This trip is the antithesis of that. We are all in on the Saudi Arab Sunni divide. So the problem is, when we get caught in this swing, it's not good policy. We need to be steady, predictable. What does the U.S. want this region to look like in the next 20 to 30 years? Where are our levers of influence? And we do need to keep faith with our allies, and our traditional allies are the Saudis, but we can't be beholden to their agenda either. And what they're doing in Yemen and elsewhere may not serve our broader interests. So that's where we have to be really careful.
And before we wrap this conversation up, when you talk to administration officials, as I do with some frequency, They say, look, we're making progress against ISIS in Yemen. And they say that. But it's not our progress, actually. It's the Saudis' progress.
Exactly. And we're selling them the weapons to do it. Yeah.
We're selling the weapons to carry out the fight. And they are unabashed in their eagerness to elevate the symbolism of this relationship along this trip. This will have already happened, dear listeners and viewers. Big money will be committed by the Saudis to the United States in terms of infrastructure, funneled through various funds that they operate in the United States. And then there will be a large, this will have already happened,
massive
arms deals with the Saudis.
Massive.
Before we wrap this conversation up, because I really do think this trip sort of is about the first 3 or 4 days and the rest of it is kind of just holding serve in a tennis match, if you'll let me to inject that ridiculous metaphor. The Saudi thing is just huge. I think it will be the thing that reverberates throughout the region more than anything else. Arms sales, Saudi investment. It's like America and Saudi. Everyone else is get in line.
Well, and they're even advocating an Arab NATO. Against, they are articulating a new regional security architecture that would be U.S. engaged, Saudi buying U.S. weapons systems. And again, that alliance will be perceived as anti-Shia. Again, the Iranian presidential elections, the elections will have already been held when the president arrives in the Middle East. So the messages here are huge. And the Israeli government fully supports this strong stability, stronger Saudi-Israeli relationship. So I agree with you. This is the first stop is really the most important. The only time we'll really hear the president give a major address. And the rest, I'm told, there's really not going to be a lot of press availabilities. They're not doing the new normal. So we'll really have that to go off, and then we'll see how the rest of the trip goes.
We promised you a way forward machine, didn't we, Steve?
Absolutely.
I think we built one.
Nice job.
Not because of you, or not because of me, but because of Heather Connolly.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Our wonderful, esteemed, and now treasured member of the Hall of Participants of the Takeout Podcast. Just so you remember,
where is the Hall of Participants located, by the way?
It's in a shoebox. Somewhere near the basement of the dwelling I currently occupy. That's all the detail I will provide. Heather Connolly, just so you know, because it's really important, she spent her whole life earning this title, so dang it, it's important that it be said. One more time. Senior Vice President for Europe, Eurasia, and don't ever forget the Arctic, and Director of the Europe Program for the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Heather, we could not have asked for a better mechanic to build the Way Forward machine, and we thank you.
Thank you for having me help you build it. It's been great to be with you.
You have been listening to The Takeout.
The Takeout is produced by Arden Farhi, Nick Feynman, Katiana Krachenko, and CBS Radio News. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and visit takeoutpodcast.com for more information.
But I hear where they don't want me to use hairspray. They want me to use the pump because the other one, which I really like better than going bing, 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 and then it comes out in big globs, right? And you're stuck in your hair and you say, oh, my God, I got to take a shower again. My hair's all screwed up, right? I want to use hairspray. They say, don't use hairspray. It's bad for the ozone. So I'm sitting in this concealed apartment, this concealed unit. You know, I really do live in a very nice apartment, right? But it's sealed. It's beautiful. I don't think anything gets out.